This is Audible.
Welcome. You are about to embark on a unique learning adventure from the Great Courses. Our courses are crafted to be entertaining journeys, both comprehensive and fascinating. They're designed to expand horizons, deepen understanding, and foster epiphanies in a broad array of subjects and university-level disciplines. The lecturers are university professors and subject matter experts carefully selected by the Great Courses and its customers for their intellectual distinction and exceptional abilities to teach. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalogs or visit our website at thegreatcourses.com and imagine how much you can learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the company of some of the greatest minds in the world. These lectures are titled The Barbarian Empires of the Steppes. Your lecturer is Dr. Kenneth W. Harrell. Dr. Harrell is professor of classical and Byzantine history at Tulane University, where he has taught for more than 30 years. He earned his MA and PhD from Yale University. A specialist in ancient Mediterranean civilizations and a veteran field researcher, Dr. Harrell serves on the editorial board of the American Journal of Archaeology. He is also known for his studies of ancient coinage and is a fellow and trustee of the American Numismatic Society. Dr. Harrell has earned Tulane's Student Body Award for Excellence in Teaching on multiple occasions and is the recipient of Baylor University's nationwide Robert Foster Cherry Award for Great Teachers. His other great courses include Alexander the Great and the Macedonian Empire, The Fall of the Pagans and the Origins of Medieval Christianity, The World of Byzantium and Great Ancient Civilizations of Asia Minor. Lecture 1. Steppes and Peoples.
On February 13, 1258, Hulagu, a grandson of Genghis Khan, led his Mongol army into the city of Baghdad, which is today in lower Iraq. This city at the time was the capital of the Abbasid Empire, the Abbasid Caliphate. And it was the greatest city of Islam, and the Mongol army carried out a sack that reputedly lasted for 40 days. The level of destruction was quite unimaginable at the time. The Abbasid Caliph, a rather gentle man who is the religious and political successor to Muhammad, has surrendered the city on terms back on the 10th of February. But because the city had resisted initially, the Mongol Khan, Hulagu, felt all bets were off, and he turned loose his soldiers to conduct one of the great massacres of any Islamic city. It was not only the colossal destruction of human life, and Muslim chronicles speak in great detail about the destruction, but it was also the cultural destruction that went on. Mongol soldiers ran through the city, deliberately destroying mosques, madrasas, plundering the libraries. Thousands of manuscripts were thrown into the Tigris, and there are reports that the Tigris ran black with ink because of so much of the destroyed literature, and then the Tigris ran red with blood as the populations were marched out onto the Great Plains, and they were executed, many of them by beheading, and great mounds of skulls were raised up to celebrate this Mongol victory. Furthermore, the city was largely burned, and with that went so many of the monuments, the palaces, the mosques, that had been really the model for Islamic architecture since the 8th century AD. The only population to be spared was a small group of Christians known as Nestorian Christians, and that's because, reputedly, one of the wives of the Mongol Khan was a Christian herself. It is hard to calculate the losses, cultural and human, at Baghdad. Reports run as many as 800,000 people were in the city. Clearly, the city was one of the great urban populations of the world at the time. Some would put those numbers as high as 1 million. It was swollen with many refugees from the countryside at the start of the siege. In addition, The losses, the intellectual, the religious, the art losses are enormous. Baghdad had been an intellectual center for centuries. It is where the Quran was edited in its final version, where the great debates had taken place among Islamic theologians. Was the Quran the uncreated word of God spoken directly through Muhammad in Arabic, or was it to be taken allegorically? It is where Persian and Arabic scholars had drawn on the knowledge of Greek antiquity, of Hindu India, and of Persian Iran, and gained great achievements in mathematics. They created algebra, in medicine, in geography and history. All of this legacy went up in flames in that destruction on that fateful day and the 40 days that followed. The image is riveting, and it still endures in the Islamic world as one of the great catastrophes. In fact, many a Muslim might say that the Mongols represented a great catastrophe, their worst nightmare of barbarians. They typified the clash of barbarian peoples of the steppes and the civilized peoples of civilizations such as Europe, the Islamic world, India, and China. But is this image true? Is this the only image? Are the Mongols just ruthless conquerors? And so were the previous people of the steppes. Was their role to be either defeated or, better yet, civilized and incorporated and assimilated? Well, what we're going to look at is not only this image, but perhaps other images that are equally telling of the relationship between nomadic peoples and the sedentary civilizations. In this course, I propose to look at all of these images, why they spring to us, why they have come down through the historical record, and why the people of the steppes have come to play such an important role. Ever since the first people known as PIE, Proto-Indo-European speakers, first domesticated the horse and made possible movement of peoples over the grasslands of Eurasia, a people who were hardy, capable of living on that climate and wresting a living from demanding conditions of following the seasons and their herds, ever searching for pastures and water, and constantly exchanging whatever goods they had for food and luxuries from the urban literate civilizations. This course is a daunting challenge, and it has been put together, researched, and offered in response to customers of the great courses, as well as my own students. And these questions are arising largely because of a fascination, not only in the steppes, but two of the great conquerors, two of the men that epitomize that image of the sack of Baghdad. One of them is the granddad of Hulagu, who sacked Baghdad, and that is Genghis Khan, a household word, and the other is Attila the Hun. Both of these conquerors are seen as the worst nightmare of civilized populations. They are great conquerors. We conjure up the images of the horse archers, the great cavalry armies that swept over the steppes. And the image has been enduring. It fascinates. It repels. It has attracted many, many people to question how did these conquerors come about and where do they fit in the larger scope of history. I can say on a very unscientific method of polling my students over a number of years that among the two conquerors, Genghis Khan, whose real name was Temujin, he gets the name Genghis Khan, Universal Lord, in 1206, a great name. Genghis Khan scores 2-1 over Attila the Hun, who has perhaps a better name, Scourge of God, among students and various acquaintances of mine in terms of barbarian recognition. That is, Genghis Khan is seen as a greater and more ferocious conqueror than Attila the Hun. In my opinion, my favorite is Tamerlane, who is a really distant third, and he has the title Prince of Destruction. I think that's perhaps one of the best titles of all time. And again, you have to put this down to a mild-mannered academic with a fascination for these great Mongol and other steppe armies, and hoping that by preferring such titles that your students pay attention to you and learn. But seriously, these images of these great conquerors pose a daunting challenge because what do they represent to us? How did they come about? What was their importance? And putting together this lecture, these set of lectures, For the great courses, I hope to answer some of those questions. Why were they successful? And why did they build great empires? What were the secrets of that success? And at the same time, why did these empires come to pass? Why did an empire, especially of Attila, fragment so quickly, whereas the Mongol Empire had a much greater and longer legacy for us today? In addition, Attila and Genghis Khan have spawned all sorts of popular images and interests, that can be measured in various ways besides that very unscientific poll I take each year with my students. One is the image, for instance, of Attila the Hun in popular novels and paintings and in tales and legends. Today, Hungarians and Turks claim Attila as one of their own. And this is very, very odd, since Hungarians and Turks have fought each other for 400 years. Hungarians can proudly point, and it's on display, ironically, in Vienna at the Kunsthistorisches Museum, the sword of Attila. This is some kind of legendary sword in the Middle Ages that the kings of Hungary claimed had come from Attila. Sure, it's a legend, but the legend rings true of the importance of the image of Attila to later Hungarians, even though they're not at all directly related to him. Other Turks are the same way. Many Turks have the name Attila. And ironically, the Turkish invasion of Cyprus in 1975 toppled that military government and led to the partition of Cyprus today was codename Operation Attila. Attila has also inspired some of my favorite grade B movies. My favorite one is actually called Sign of the Pagan, released in 1954. And Jack Palance is the quintessential Attila on the big screen. Genghis Khan has inspired almost as many images as Attila the Hun. And then again, these images have fed into our understanding and researching of this course. He has not fared as well on the big screen, at least until recently. There's a film called Mongol, released in 2007, which is based on the secret history of the Mongols, Temujin growing up. And the Japanese actor there, Tada Nobu Asano, plays a very, very credible Genghis. And it really, the film really creates the world of the steppes in the 13th century quite successfully. There's also lots of statues, especially put up in the current Mongolian Republic. In every public square, you get statues of Genghis Khan. Sometimes Genghis Khan is featured as almost an Abraham Lincoln type figure, rather amusing. But after all, he did legislate on Yasa, the customs of the Mongols. At other occasions, he's seen as a conqueror. He's put on top of triumphal arches, which is a really weird mix of iconography. And sometimes the mounted Genghis Khan statue looks like it's leaping into the middle of thin air. There's also statues to Genghis Khan in the cities of the Inner Mongolia, now part of the Republic of China. They don't seem to be quite as widespread, in some cases not as flattering either. But all of these images bring to bear very much that central question I asked, you know, why do these images endure? There was also a third image, a third set of questions besides the two conquerors that fed into the creation of this course. And that was the image of the Silk Road. Customers of the great courses, students, acquaintances of mine, all have some sense of the Silk Road. The great caravans that twisted their way across dangerous steppes and through great mountain passes across the Pamirs into Fergana, the remote fable cities of Samarkand and Bukhara. These are very glamorous, romantic images, and they've endured for a very long time in novels and bad movies and paintings. Even the earliest archaeologists who went there to excavate the cities of the Tarim Basin. In some ways, the images ring true. There is a certain glamour, even though it's pretty time-consuming and not very comfortable to ride camels on caravans. But the images are significant in this regard. They balance that image of the bloodthirsty conquerors, that sack of Baghdad I had mentioned earlier. And they drive home the fact that the interaction between nomadic peoples of the steppes and the great civilizations of Europe, the Middle East, India, and China was more than just warfare, but also involved cultural exchange, involved trade, because on those routes would travel not only merchants, but monks and mystics. And those roots would be very, very important for the spread of all sorts of religions across Eurasia, notably Christianity, and above all, Buddhism and Islam. And the impact of those religions and the distribution of those religions across Eurasia are a result of the great empires of these nomadic peoples and the Silk Road. I want to return briefly to the starting point, the Mongols sacking Baghdad in 1258. Yes, in some ways, they are the epitome of the nomadic warrior. They are the epitome of the conditions of the steppes that can create such a great army as well as such great atrocities, and even the very genius of Genghis Khan and his grandsons. But on the other hand, we shall see that there are also something of exceptions. But the image brings out two important issues I want to look at in this course, and that involves the steppe way of life, which we will repeatedly talk about, and how that conditioned the nomadic peoples, and how that led to all of the developments we talk about, and the steppe way of war. Well, what were those conditions on the steppes, on the Eurasian steppes? They go back at least to the 4th millennium BC. At about that time, shortly after 4000 BC, maybe around 3800 BC, a group of peoples often called the PIE, Proto-Indo-European speakers, and this is really a linguistic designation, we'll get into that in the next lectures, they perfected the nomadic way of life. And this way of life has remained consistent remarkably over the next 6,000 years or so. They are the ones who domesticate the horse. They learn how to ride horses to help move their animals to better pastures and to better sources of water. And they set the pattern of seasonal migrations as well as long-term migrations of whole peoples looking for new homelands that will people the steppes and then come to play a very, very important role in the history of all the civilizations of Eurasia, especially when we begin to get written records and we can trace the movement of these people. In addition, they invent ox carts, felt tents that can convey family and friends across the steppes. Those kind of mobile homes are today essentially called girs. It's a Turkish-Mongolian word. There are undoubtedly earlier words. And each of these girs represents a yurt, the Turkish word for a little a family, a group, a kinship group. And a group of girs might be a yurt or a kinship. One might be. And from the yurt, you build extended families and clans and eventually political orders. Incidentally, the word yurt or yurt today in modern Turkish is used for people who share living quarters in a dormitory, which is a rather good extension of the word. This pattern of moving across the steppes, already noted by the Greek historian Herodotus writing in the 5th century BC, it characterizes the movements of steppe nomads today. Furthermore, these animals were the source of milk, yogurt, and this fermented drink called kumish, fermented mare's milk, the favorite staple of Mongol armies. It sustained life, but at the same time, the nomads needed to trade. They needed to trade for vegetables, for grains, for alcoholic beverages, and all the various luxuries that were available for the literate civilizations. And so from the start, the nomadic way of life was not only harsh, but it wasn't independent. Invariably, nomadic peoples have to come to terms with peoples who engage in agriculture, who build cities, who invent writing. And invariably, there is always a tension between the nomads and the settled peoples. The steppes can get crowded very quickly. And traditionally, nomads have moved into the civilized zones, not only for trade, but as immigrants, as raiders, and sometimes as invaders and conquerors. And this is a pattern that is a result of the nomads being driven literally in a harsh life of survival. And it has major consequences in the development of great empires, as well as the redefinition and the change of nomadic life. Seldom do the nomads themselves talk to us about this way of life. And we do have some rare documents. One of the rarest is, one of the most important is the Secret History of the Mongols, which gives us a wealth of information about nomadic life, centering on the remarkable career of Genghis Khan. And many of the details in that history can be applied to what archaeology and what various incidental references in chronicles and geographies tell us about the nomadic peoples. Well, the way of life is remarkably consistent across time and space. The Indo-European speakers devise it. It is picked up by other speakers, particularly Turkish and Mongolian speakers. And that is because that pattern of life is dictated by the terrain, the extremes of temperature, the necessity of herding those animals, and following the relentless pattern of seasonal migrations. In addition, that way of life results in the development of a very distinct way of warfare. And this warfare gives the nomadic people, starting in what we call the early Iron Age, which is usually regarded as dating between about 900 and 600 BC, of mounted horse archers. That is, cavalrymen who can ride on a saddle high on the horse and have what is called a composite bow. Initially, when this was perfected by a group of nomads called the Scythians, it is debated whether there were any stirrups or not. One suggestion is there may have been a very, very primitive sort of leather loops to steady the rider. By the early 6th century AD, the Turks have introduced metal stirrups, and that gives a stability to the warrior that allows them to do the kind of riding and battle tactics that would come to epitomize steppe warfare really for the next 1,000 years. With those saddles and stirrups, nomadic cavalry could perform all sorts of maneuvers, which the cavalry of the sedentary civilizations could not. And there are several reasons for this. For one, the relentless pattern of nomadic life meant that every adult male had to know how to ride. Every free adult male was in effect a warrior. And they are trained at birth to ride these horses. And so when you speak of 1,000 or 10,000 or 20,000 warriors of Turks, that is essentially everyone from the age of 16 and 60 who can mount those horses and go into battle. In addition, they are carrying a weapon that is perfected between the 9th century BC and the 7th century AD, the so-called composite bow. And this is sometimes known as a recurve bow. It looks like half a figure eight. It is a very, very powerful small bow. It is extremely difficult to make. You have to glue different types of horn and wood. It takes months for the thing to dry. Then you have to string it and equip it with proper arrows. But once you perfect this bow making, that weapon gives you a firepower that really is not exceeded until the invention of handheld firearms. And that meant horse archers, especially when they have stirrups, could ride close up to the opponents and shoot arrows into the opponents, maybe as close as 20 yards, 10 yards, and then turn on a dime and flee. And invariably, the armies of sedentary civilizations would get so angry, they would pursue, they would lose formation, they'd lose cohesion, and then those nomads could turn about and attack their opponents who were disorganized and drive them off the battlefield. If the opponent was more wary and wouldn't engage in direct battle, the horse archers could then engage in strategic skirmishing, attacking of columns, of cutting off supplies, and eventually wearing down opponents until they essentially gave up. So both tactically and strategically, it is extremely difficult to bring these warriors to battle, and especially to decisive battle. And the nomadic horse archers maintain that military supremacy for the next 1,000 years, and it comes to characterize warfare on the steppes. And in the end, the best way to defeat steppe nomads is to mount your own steppe nomads. And many emperors realize this, the emperors of China, of India, the Abbasid caliphs. In addition to these two important aspects in the course, that is the way of life and the way of war, we have to look at these developments and the use of nomadic institutions to build great empires, both on the steppes and in the surrounding areas. We have to put them in space and time. As I mentioned, this is a daunting course. First, we're going to cover an awful lot of real estate, perhaps 2.5 million miles of Eurasian steppes and associated zones. And these would include, for instance, the grasslands of Central Europe in Hungary and in Romania today, the grasslands leading up to the Caucasus and also on the other side of the Caucasus in Azerbaijan, the Karakum, the Kızılkum, those deserts in Central Asia, the region of Transoxiana, where the great caravan cities are, the Tarim Basin, which we'll be talking about, where there are more caravan cities, and also the borderlands of China. So if you take all of those areas where nomads had historically moved about, where they have interacted with sedentary civilizations, you're looking at 6,000 miles in length. A corridor on the steppes could run anywhere from 250 miles to 500 miles. And this vast zone is essentially a highway. A highway complements to the nomadic way of life, the domestication of the horse, learning to move on those steppes, and backed up by the military power and the way of warfare. Well, keep that image of highway in mind, because it explains a great deal of what will happen. And all you need to know at the moment, geographically, because we'll talk about geography in more detail as we move to the different parts of the steppes, there are essentially three zones. There is a western set of steppes, and these steppes stretch from the lower Danube essentially to the Ural north of the Caspian Sea, and they extend down to the Caucasus Mountains. And I'll be calling them the Pontic-Caspian steppes or the South Russian steppes. Then, continuously, there really isn't any break, you have the central steppes, and they will stretch from the Caspian, the shores of the Caspian, east around the Aral Sea, or what used to be the Aral Sea. The place has really been drained in recent years by Soviet development projects, to the river Jaxartes, and eastward to the Altai Mountains. And that is a region we call the central steppes, and that is a distinct zone in itself. And then from the Altai Mountains east, north of China, and it's bordered on the south by the Tarim Basin and the Gobi Desert, are the eastern steppes, these Mongolian grasslands, and they essentially stretch to Manchuria. And Manchuria is divided off by the Khingan Mountains, and Manchuria is really a much more lush landscape with forests and valleys, and that defines the eastern zone. So that is the great highway upon which this historical drama will be played. It should also be noted that this highway has some important exit ramps. Those include exit ramps into Central Europe, especially the Danube. The great rivers of Russia provide contact of the nomadic peoples with the Black and the Caspian Seas. And then there are great passes over the Caucasus that allow nomadic peoples to go into what we would today call the Middle East. These are the Dariel Pass, sometimes called the Gates of Alexander the Great, and the Derbent Pass. The nomads living on the central steppes, they have their own exit ramps, particularly across the Jaxartes. And that leads into a region we call Transoxiana today. And Transoxiana is home to great caravan cities, Bukhara, Samarkand, and it is defined on the south by the Oxus River. And then finally, there are lots of exit ramps between the eastern steppes and the Chinese Empire, much to the dismay of many Chinese emperors. And finally, I want to close with a sense of time. This drama occurs over a vast amount of time, 6,000 years, starting in the 4th millennium BC, and closes really with the end of the Mongol legacy in the 16th century. And to order this information, we have to impose some sort of control. And what I've chosen is to divide time into